It's amazing when you think about it. He was nailed to a cross of wood, and yet he made the ground upon which it stood. That's the Messiah, and the Jews just totally missed it.
Pastor Brett Menner notes how even the opposition man can be used for God's sovereign purpose.
But in the same way that they missed all the details that the Bible gave them, this is not our Messiah, we will not have this, crucify him, they yelled. Meanwhile, they didn't know all of that was working together to bring their Messiah so that he would save them from their sins.
John chapter 18 tells of the unfolding of God's sovereign plan through the trial of Jesus before Pilate. Though the religious leaders sought to condemn him, their actions fulfilled the very prophecy of how he would die, nailed to a cross. But Pastor Brett Metter helps us to see in today's word how Christ's path to the cross was no accident, but a divine necessity for our salvation.
There was a professional golfer a generation ago, Tommy Bolt. He was known for his hot temper, but he was also known for having what some people called the perfect golf swing. And he was quite the golfer, won many titles and what have you. But he was playing in a tournament in Los Angeles and reluctantly agreed to have a caddy that was known for constant chatter and talking all the time. Tommy Bolt said, okay, you can be my caddy, but don't say anything except unless I ask you a question. All I want is a yes or a no. And the caddy said, yes. So they went out there and, you know, he was, you know, in the tournament doing pretty well, but he came to a very difficult situation on a fairway, tough shot under a tree branch. He had to go over a lake onto the green, and Bolt asked his caddy, should I use my 5-iron? And the caddy said, no. Should I use my 6-iron? No. Bolt, you know, kind of roared at him. You don't know anything. Just watch this. And he grabbed his 5-iron and sure enough, perfect hit. Under the branch, over the lake, and it dropped on the green about 1 foot from the cup. And Bolt confidently, smugly came over to the caddy and said, okay, you can talk now. What do you think of that? And the caddy said, Mr. Bolt, that wasn't your ball. Sometimes you think you know stuff. Sometimes you think you are infallible and you are so brilliant and you know everything. And, you know, it's really one of those life-changing moments when you realize, man, I was so wrong. Now, some of you are probably sitting here, well, that's never happened to me because I'm never wrong. Now, if that's you, oh, you've got a rude awakening coming for you. You know what's so funny? Everybody's wrong once in a while. Someday you're going to stand before the Lord. And isn't it shocking? Everything that you thought was going to be sort of revealed is true or false. All your opinions, all your strong attitudes about this or that, the Lord's just gonna shake it all out. Was that good or bad? Were you right or wrong? And I think it's gonna be one of those moments that are gonna be very humbling how wrong we were. Mike Winger, he's a pastor, teacher, more of a Bible answer guy, you know, really on YouTube. Great guy. Mike Winger was talking about something this last week I caught, and his little short video is called, You're Ignorant and So Am I. And I thought, what's that all about? But sure enough, he kind of went on. He talked about, he said, when I was 3, I thought I was smart. But then when I turned 7, I thought my 3-year-old self was dumb. When I was 20, I thought my 10-year-old self was a total numbskull. And now I'm really smart. I get it now. I'm an adult. I know all things. But then you hit 30. I was like, man, when I was 20, oh boy, what an idiot. We're always at our smartest in life and rarely recognize how ignorant we are until much later. Boy, that's true, isn't it? How ignorant are you? Now, before you answer that, how ignorant are you compared to, say, not your 10-year-old self, how ignorant are you compared to God? Because that's a profound gap. God, who's omniscient and knows all things, and yet we think we're right about stuff. And, you know, you kind of see this when you hear people ask questions, you know, well, if God is love, then why does he send people to hell? And they think they gotcha. Oh, that's a gotcha question. What Christian can answer that question? Well, actually, a lot of Christians can answer it. It's actually a pretty good answer. It takes a while to talk about it, and you got to know your Bible and stuff like that, but we'll even talk about that even today. Does God really, you know, send you to hell, or do you send yourself there? God has done everything apart from forcing you. You've got the option to go to heaven if you want to. It's right there for you. So it's really a false dilemma, and people think they're so smart, but really, it's really dumb. I'm not saying the question is dumb, but the attitude often behind it is really dumb because it's asked with sort of the notion like, oh, I got God on this one. If God could, so, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? When you're highfalutin thinking, well, I've really got God, I got a gotcha question for God. Someday you're gonna stand before God, your knees will be knocking and your pants will be wetting. I'm pretty sure you're gonna be totally humbled if you had that sort of arrogant attitude against God. You know what, that's gonna be most painful because, you know, as Christians, we're gonna stand before the Bema Seat judgment of Christ and probably recognize some of that. But the one that's gonna be detrimental is the great white throne judgment. There in Revelation chapter 20, where all the world who rejected Christ, rejected God's loving plan to be saved and go to heaven, they're gonna stand before the great white throne. And all of their highfalutin, arrogant, prideful attitudes and thoughts about things are gonna be revealed as just dumb, false. And it'll be revealed before all the world and before God himself. And that's where the great white throne, if you find yourself there, the next thing after that is Gehenna, which is a Greek word for hell, lake of fire, eternal damnation, hell. And a lot of people don't wanna talk about that. Some people try not to believe in hell. They just wish it out of existence. But the Bible is very clear. In fact, the Bible talks more about hell than it talks about heaven, shockingly. The biggest question you will ever answer in your life is, what do you think about Jesus Christ? Where do you land? Is he God like he claimed to be? Is he the one who died for the sins of the world? And by his redemptive work on the cross, you can be saved and your sins forgiven? Or is he just some carpenter or a nice guy or a teacher, or like Oprah Winfrey believes, he's a nice guy who's just a good prophet and said nice things? And if you believe that, your opinion is wrong. Jesus made it really clear who he claimed to be. Well, how do we know that what he claimed was correct? Well, he said, this is the one sign I'll show you. Destroy this body, and in 3 days, I'll raise it up from the dead. And Jesus rose from the grave, and hundreds of people saw him after he rose from the grave. And all those people were willing to die brutal, torturous deaths, unwilling to deny that Jesus rose from the grave. They were all so convinced that they were willing to die torturous deaths. It's an amazing story. One of the most irrefutable facts in all of history that Jesus proved his claim by resurrecting from the dead. In John chapter 18, we have the most overt rejection of Jesus Christ. These are people that say, we don't believe him. Not only do we not believe him, we hate him and we're gonna kill him. That's where we find ourselves in John chapter 18. These Jewish people of Jesus's day were extremely stubborn. They built their sort of case against Jesus. And their case was flimsy at best. It was like they said, well, he broke the law. Did Jesus break the law ever? No, he broke their dumb traditions. You see, they added to the law of the Jews a bunch of dumb traditions that were stupid, but they thought they were as much as important as the law. They were just dead wrong. So when Jesus and his disciples were eating corn on the side of the road there and they didn't wash their hands and Jesus healed a guy on the Sabbath day, those were just part of their dumb rules. Jesus was just doing what was good. But they were so convinced, oh, he's breaking the law. He's a blasphemer and he's a horrible guy and he deserves death. And so convinced were they that they're gonna carry this out. The problem is the Jews can't perform capital punishment officially during this time because the Roman Empire, Romans were in control. We'll talk more about that in a second. So the Jews have to go circuitously around to kill Jesus. They have to not do it their way, they have to do it the Roman way. What's their way? Well, if you were gonna kill someone for a criminal action in Jewish tradition and even the Old Testament law, what was the proper method of killing someone? You'd stone them to death. Stoning was a horrible way to die, by the way. In Jerusalem around the first century, the way they did it, there was a gate in Jerusalem called the Dung Gate. And the dung gates, of course, what it sounds like. It's where they hauled all the camel, donkey, goat, sheep, dung, and wheelbarrows. They hauled it out through that gate. And they had these big pits dug out in the dirt. And they just throw all the dung in these pits. And then eventually they'd cover it up with dirt and then, you know, let it all sort of become, you know, fertilizer or whatever. But it was sort of the armpit of Jerusalem. It was like the grimiest, grossest place you'd ever want to go. So when it came time to stone someone to death, they'd send you through the dung gate. Josephus writes about this in his Antiquities of the Jews, the works of Josephus, but he writes about how they would make the people go out and they'd go literally make them stand in the middle of the manure hole. There's actually accounts where people are like waist deep in manure. They had to stand there, and then the people would circle around and throw big rocks, and they'd smash your skull eventually, and you'd plop down in the manure face down, and then you just kind of sink in there and die. And then eventually they'd cover you over with some dirt, and it was the most defiling, most gross way to die. I mean, it was horrific and painful, suffering. That was the typical, you know, way of the Jews. But why did Jesus not die that way? That would have been the normal way for Jews to kill someone that they hated. Well, therein lies a story, and it brings us to our text right here. For the Jews have to go to Pontius Pilate, and that's where we pick it up here in John chapter 18, verse 31. In John 18, 31, it says, "Then said Pilate unto them, Take ye him, and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said to them, It is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die." What's going on here? The Jews are bringing Jesus to Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate says, "You guys deal with it. It's a Jewish problem. You use your law, whatever. I don't want anything to do with this." But they say, "Well, we can't because we think this guy's worthy of death, and we don't have the authority to kill anybody because of the Romans. So we're putting this on you." And then this verse 32 is sort of almost like a parenthetical statement. Why was this happening with Pontius Pilate and the Jews? It was that the prophetic saying of Jesus predicted prophetically, not only that he would go to Jerusalem and die, but the method by which he would be killed, and that is none other than crucifixion, signifying what death he should die, that is crucifixion. Crucifixion. Why did Jesus have to die on a cross? Why didn't he get stoned to death or some other death? Well, there's a lot of reasons that the Bible gives us of why Jesus would be sort of, instead of killed on a cross, like with a stoning custom, instead he would be crucified. But the Jews were all for this. But little did they know their own stupidity, because not only were they dumb about Jesus getting it wrong, but little did they know, by going to Pontius Pilate, they were fulfilling Bible prophecy about Jesus and the method by which he'd die. And I want to show you that. The first thing, as we kind of break down these couple verses, I want you to notice a few things. Number one, notice the inaccuracy of the people. They were so sure of themselves, but they were just simply wrong. Sometimes I wonder, you know, as I read the story, the narrative of the Gospels, did these guys know that Jesus really was the Messiah, but were so stubborn they didn't want to give it to him? You know, you might say, "Well, Brett, they just didn't know. They just didn't know that Jesus was the Messiah, and they made a mistake." Well, yeah, but they'd seen him do all the miracles. They'd seen him raise people from the dead. Jesus never did anything wrong. He was perfectly sinless, and yet they had built their case against him. Well, why would they do that? If they knew he was the Messiah, why wouldn't they follow him? Well, that's a great question, and I can speculate. Maybe they were worried about their own job security. Because if Jesus really was the Messiah, that put them in a really bad light. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians, the Sanhedrin, the high priest, Caiaphas, and Annas, that would have messed up their gig. You see, they were really corrupt by that time. Caiaphas was not really even a religious leader. He was a political leader. He was supposed to be the high priest, like the Old Testament sons of Aaron. But instead, all he was a sort of a puppet of the Roman Empire. By that time, they were also corrupt. The idea of the truth of who Jesus really was, that put them in real trouble. So it's almost like they would not believe in him because they could not believe in him. But they were dead wrong. So they say sort of piously, "It's not lawful for us to put any man to death." Like they're law-abiding Roman citizens and they like the Roman plan better. That was just them being corrupt. But they're technically right, they couldn't put to death Jesus by stoning because the Romans did something earlier that took away their sovereignty as a people. And this is also fulfilling Bible prophecy. There's so much about Bible prophecy that's interesting, especially when it comes to the predictions around Jesus Christ, his coming, and there's hundreds and hundreds of prophecies. We'll touch on a few of them today, but one of the things, Rome declared sovereignty over Jerusalem somewhere in the early, you know, teens of the millennia. Some say around the year 12 AD, Rome finally said to the Jews in Israel, "You're under our power." You know, before they were sort of a vassal state kind of the Roman Empire. But right around 12 AD, they suddenly lost the ability to govern themselves. And the Romans were their governors now. They were supposed to be citizens of Rome, basically. And to sort of accept that. When that happened in 12 AD, again, Eusebius writes about this event, and he writes about when the sovereignty of the Jews was taken away by the Romans. Suddenly the Jews freaked out in the streets of Rome. The old men ripped their clothes and pulled their beards and they cried out, "Oh, the Lord has forsaken us, the Lord has forsaken us." Now, why were they so dramatic about that? Rome did that with all the other nations that they conquered too. What was the big deal for the Jews? Well, it had to do with a prophecy that was given at the very beginning of the Jewish nation back when Jacob, later who was called Israel, the father of the Jews, he was passing out blessings and curses to his 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel. And there in Genesis 49, well, I'll just show you, Judah, the son, was the one who was gonna get this sort of blessing. So Jacob lays his hand on Judah and starts to say this, Genesis 49:9. He says, "Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up?" And then notice this little verse 10. This is where the Jews started. This is where they were ripping their beards out because of this. It says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come." Shiloh is another name the Jews would recognize as the coming of the Messiah. So what's this saying? The scepter, which is the authority or sovereignty of their nation, would not depart from Judah, which is also an idiom eventually for all of Israel, Judah, nor the lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. So the Jews took this and thought, well, great. We're not gonna lose our sovereignty as a people, and then the Messiah is gonna come and we'll be good after that. That's what they believed. And then it goes on. It says, "Unto him shall the gathering of the people be." Who will the gathering of the people be? To the Shiloh, the Messiah. Verse 11, "Binding his foal into the vine, his ass's colt to the choice vine." Does this ring a bell? If you know the story of Jesus, there's some interesting implications of this whole narrative, the colt of a donkey, the vine. And then it gets even more prophetic when he says, "He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes." If you know the second coming of Jesus, that's describing that. If you read Revelation 19, there's a huge correlation. The blood of grapes on his vesture of clothing, speaking of blood. Verse 12, "His eyes shall be red with wine, his teeth white with milk." This is a massive prophecy. We don't have time to go into all the details here, but this is a foretelling of Jesus. But what happened was, right around 12 AD, when the Romans said, "Jews, you've lost your sovereignty," the reason the men freaked out is because they thought, oh no, this prophecy is not true. That before the scepter of authority would pass from Israel, before that could happen, the Messiah will come. And they realized the Messiah hadn't come. But wait, had the Messiah come by 12 AD? Right around 12 AD is when the Messiah, Jesus, was a 12-year-old kid sitting in Jerusalem confounding the priests and answering their questions and blowing them out of the water. And the Messiah had come. This prophecy did happen perfectly. They didn't know it. They didn't know that Jesus was on the scene. Again, they were wrong. Isn't it interesting how right you can think you are and you think you know stuff, but they were just wrong. The Messiah really had come and the scepter would not depart until the Messiah came. And as soon as the Messiah came, the scepter did in fact part from them. The Jews were watching for this. What did they miss? They missed the coming of Christ. Do you remember when the Magi from Babylon came over from the east and they went to talk to the Jewish religious leaders, said, "Where is this Messiah of yours supposed to be born?" Because they knew enough to be dangerous. The Babylonians knew to follow the star and they were doing that whole thing. But they asked the Jews, "Where do we find this?" Well, and the Jews said, "Well, he's supposed to be born in Bethlehem or someplace like that." Because they knew that from the Old Testament prophecy. But isn't it funny? It was the Babylonian Magi that wanted to see the birth of the Messiah and went to go to Bethlehem while the religious leaders wouldn't get off their rear ends. They just sat in Jerusalem, "Oh, our Messiah is supposed to be over there somewhere in Bethlehem." So meanwhile, Christ was born and they missed it. They were wrong. They were dead wrong, but they thought they were so right. Oh, those dumb Magi, what do they think they're doing? But the Magi were actually right. So when Jesus was baptized and his ministry began, they were so thick. They said, "Ah, who is this guy?" And they rejected him. They despised him. Ultimately, they would say, "We will not have this man rule over us." And then they said, "We're gonna kill him." So they sent him to Pontius Pilate, like in our text here. And what would the Romans do? Well, Pilate would reluctantly, even though he said, "I find no fault in this man," eventually his hand would sort of be forced to crucify Jesus because of the pressure from the Jews. What an irony. Speaking of the scepter prophecy just before they crucified Jesus. You remember what the Roman soldiers did? They mocked him, placing a crown of thorns on his head, cloaking him in a purple robe, which speaks of royalty. And they gave him a scepter in his hand, like a fake rod that was a scepter of authority. That's the story. In Matthew 27, verses 27 through 31, it tells that whole story. And they bowed to him and said, "Hail, King of the Jews." And then they'd punch him in the face. They literally took the scepter that they put in his hand to mock him and beat him over the head with the scepter. How supremely ironic it is when you think about that. The symbol of worldly authority, the scepter, was used to batter the one who holds the highest authority in the heaven and on the earth. The scepter that they put in Jesus' hand, they beat him over the head with it. The scepter of authority, interesting story. And as you follow it through the Bible, man, you realize the Bible is so precise in its prophecies concerning Jesus. But how many of us go around complaining all the while God's plan is unfolding around us? You know, we get bummed out. Oh, I can't believe that happened in my life. But like the Jews who thought they knew everything, they really didn't. And meanwhile, everything was going around for their Messiah to be set up for his first coming. You see, the Jews didn't realize he was coming in two advents. The first coming was the babe born in Bethlehem. The second coming would be the second coming of Christ that's yet to happen. But that's when he's gonna come, not as a carpenter, not as a, you know, a humble servant. He's coming as a conquering king in his second coming. And that's the description of the end of these verses here. You see the two comings in this whole prophecy of Genesis 49. But in the same way that they missed all the details that the Bible gave them, and they thought they were so right, this is not our Messiah, we will not have this. Crucify him, they yelled. Meanwhile, they didn't know all of that was working together to bring their Messiah so that he would save them from their sins. It's amazing when you think about it. He was nailed to a cross of wood, and yet he made the ground upon which it stood. That's the Messiah, and the Jews just totally missed it.
Pastor Brett Metter, marveling at the sovereign will of God being accomplished while utilizing the opposition of man for his divine purpose. And there's more to come by Pastor Brett, as he'll continue his message next time on Today's Word. And I trust you'll stay right there as Pastor Brett will actually join me in a moment. Today's Word is the radio ministry of Athey Creek Church, just south of Portland, Oregon, where Pastor Brett Metter is the senior pastor. Our vision on Today's Word is to proclaim the hope of salvation and help people know Jesus through careful study of the Bible. We invite you to find out more by going to todayswordradio.com. If you've missed any portion of this message, you'll find all of Pastor Brett's messages online at todayswordradio.com. All right, Pastor Brett has joined me now. Brett, as this Today's Word radio program continues to expand across the nation, there are more people who want to know how this community at Athey Creek Church has grown like it has.
When people ask me that question, I chuckle because the verse that comes to mind is where scriptures say the Lord, you know, uses the weak and the foolish to confound the wise. And we chuckle because the Lord really does use very imperfect people. And So, you know, we really can't take any credit for what the Lord's doing here. But in short, I think what we're seeing at Athey Creek is simply the power of the Word of God. Yeah. I believe people are seriously hungry for the Bible. You know, there's been a trend in churches, and I don't want to sound critical, but I think there's this pressure on young pastors to teach exciting, new topicals. You know, sadly, in some circles, it's become sort of a TED Talk sort of format of churches. In my humble opinion, we need to get back to the whole Bible. You know, Acts 20:27 is where Paul told the elders at Ephesus, he said, "I have not shunned to declare unto you all the counsel of God." And so what we're seeing at Athey is just verse by verse, chapter by chapter through the Bible. And people, when they come and they realize, I'm not trying to be flashy or come up with anything new, but kind of old school J. Vernon McGee, you know, people think I'm coming up with something new going through the Bible verse by verse, but it's actually really old what I'm doing. And I think our culture, I think that's what people really are hungry for. And so that's what I think one of the big reasons we're seeing growth in our church and really exponential growth because of his word.
Absolutely, Pastor Brett. Thank you for that. And if you'd like more information about Athey Creek Church, Pastor Brett Metter, or Today's Word, you can visit our website at todayswordradio.com. That's todayswordradio.com. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Next time, Pastor Brett Metter will continue to examine how the religious leaders' errant beliefs about Jesus actually help fulfill prophecy of Jesus' ultimate purpose. Today's Word with Pastor Brett Metter is an outreach of Athey Creek Church in West Lynn, Oregon.